Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. We have a very exciting show today because it will be timely for all of us in the next week or two. If you're a native Atlantan, you know what I'm talking about. We're getting ready for that green, yellow-green cloud to spawn above our head, and that means allergy season. So to kick off allergy season, when we'll all be dealing with sneezing, coughing, runny noses, itchy, watery eyes, I brought you an expert today, allergy expert. I'm happy to have as my guest Dr. Alan Redding with me today. Dr. Redding is a board-certified allergist and immunologist. He is in private practice at the Redding Allergy and Asthma Center in the 75 and West Paces area. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He got his medical degree from the Medical College of Georgia, so he's a Georgia boy, and also went to get his internal medicine certification at University of South Carolina, and then went on to specialize in allergy and immunology at the University of Tennessee. And we know each other. We are friends as well as colleagues, so I'm thrilled to have you here today.
Good afternoon.
Very good.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Let's start off. I think a lot of people suffer from allergies, but they really have no idea what is kind of happening in their body. So can you kind of kick off the show by telling us just the very basics of allergies and how they affect us and what's kind of happening in there?
Yes. To put it simply, allergies are caused by an abnormal response by certain cells in the body to what are normally harmless substances. The allergens is the word we use for a substance that causes allergy. They're typically proteins, but they can be other carbohydrates and things like that. But you can have inhaled allergens, you can have ingested allergens, and then you can have contact allergens that cause allergic contact dermatitis. So there's different ways the body can be exposed to the allergen. And the abnormal response by certain cells, we call them Th2 cells, leads to a cascade of a chemical pathway cascade in the body, which leads to histamine release. The histamine then causes sneezing, itching, nasal congestion, a runny nose, and it can also lead to asthma attacks. So in most people, these substances will not cause this abnormal Th2 response. They might cause a Th1 response or no response at all, but people who have an allergic profile tend to have this Th2 response that causes the symptoms.
So how do you know if they have an allergic profile?
The only way to know for sure is to confirm it by testing for allergies, and the best way to test is with skin testing. When we do skin testing, we take small pricks of plastic devices and just barely scrape the surface of the skin, which then introduces the specific allergen into the skin. If someone is allergic, then that will start the allergic cascade, and they will get a small area of redness, swelling, and itching at the site of the test. That's the best way to test for allergies.
Okay. Now, I read in my research that something like over 10%, you suggested maybe higher than that, suffer from allergies. Is that right?
Yes. Of the American population, it could be as high as 25% may have an allergy of some form or another. Allergic disease is really much more common in developed countries.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, the most commonly accepted theory as to why that's the case is what's called the hygiene hypothesis. And that is the idea that people who grow up in clean, generally sanitized environments when they're not exposed to bacteria constantly, then they will develop the abnormal allergic response, whereas the people who grow up in environments where they may have worms, parasites, or kind of constant chronic bacterial exposure will kind of develop their immune system in a way that prevents them to ever have allergies.
Okay, so kind of like the vaccination model. So if I build up my certain antibodies for the vaccine, then eventually my body's responding to ward it off. If I never have that, then I might be more susceptible.
Yeah, in that sense, that's right, exactly.
Okay, same idea about that. Now, you mentioned asthma or allergy. How are allergies and asthma connected to each other?
Well, overall, at least 60% of people with asthma have allergies, and in children, that percent would be much higher. Allergies are not necessarily the root cause of asthma, but allergen exposure will usually trigger asthma attacks. And if you treat the allergies, then the asthma almost always gets better. For example, a landmark study in 2007 showed that children who were placed on allergy shots for 3 years had a 50% less chance of developing asthma than the children who did not take the allergy shots. And the idea behind that is that the allergy shots desensitized the patients to their allergens and actually prevented the asthma from developing.
Okay, and so you brought up differences between pediatrics, like pediatric asthma and adult asthma. So on the allergy side, I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, kids can get allergies but outgrow it, or same for the adults. The adults can go a long time and never have symptoms of allergies, but later in life they do.
Yeah, good question. Allergies can certainly develop at any age, and that goes for inhalant allergens or aeroallergens, as well as food allergens. Asthma does not develop de novo in adults as often as allergies do. So if an adult came to me with breathing symptoms, with symptoms that were suggestive of asthma, and they had never had symptoms their whole life, I'm a little bit less suspicious that they actually have asthma. It's still quite possible, though. But allergies, although they can be, they frequently do start in early childhood, they can develop it at any age later.
Okay, so if I'm that adult that I was fine for a long time, and then I moved to Atlanta, and all of a sudden I am way worse, what is happening
there? Yeah, that's a good point. Frequently, when I do see adults who come to me with recent onset symptoms of allergies, oftentimes they have moved from another part of the country or in some cases other part of the world. I would say that happens more commonly than, say, people who have lived in Atlanta their entire life who come to me and say they start having allergic symptoms. It's more common.
They've had a change of environment.
Than have the latecomers. Yeah, it's that they're now exposed to new and different trees and grasses, weeds, molds, that and because it's new, they're more likely then to start reacting to it.
Okay. Let's run down. I know there's different types of allergies, so the underlying response in your body is probably the same, but what's triggering it may be different for each person. So and we category allergies together. Let's just talk for a few minutes about food allergies, which you probably start hearing. Do you see more when foods are introduced to children, like eggs, milk, whatever, in pediatric food allergies? What do you see?
Yeah, the most common pediatric food allergy that we see is peanut, and that's becoming a trend over time.
Is it because it's more hidden in foods like peanut products or peanut oil? Or
no one knows really exactly why peanut allergy is becoming more prevalent in children. It's eaten frequently by both pregnant mothers and children. There's some studies that suggest a possible link between pregnant mothers who eat a lot of peanuts while they're pregnant might increase the chance of the child having a peanut allergy. Now, that study, the evidence is not conclusive to the point where we're making any official recommendations to pregnant mothers regarding peanut ingestion. So I'm not telling them not to eat it necessarily, but that might be one of the reasons. There could be some others too, but milk and egg allergy are other common allergens in small children, but I would say not as high as necessarily as peanut. And peanut tends to persist, whereas the milk and egg allergy, most of the time, the children will outgrow it.
At what age would they kind of be over the hump?
Milk probably, they'd probably outgrow milk allergy first. By the time they're school age, the vast majority of children who may have had a milk allergy when they were infants have outgrown it. egg allergy. Again, the majority would have probably outgrown it by school age, but there's still a significant portion that may continue to have an egg allergy even in adolescence. But
and then how would you know that? Because you'd obviously try not giving them that. When would you like reintroduce it to keep seeing if they're having the same response over time?
Well, if we knew someone had, if we had diagnosed a child with a food allergy, we would see the patient back in clinic every 1 to 2 years and do a skin test, skin test. And that's how we would use evidence before we decided to introduce it.
And
back
then you'd
into
educate the patients and their families on how to kind of get going based on those test results.
Yes.
Okay. And then for adults, I always hear about shellfish.
Yeah.
Is that like one of the most common food allergies for adults?
Yes. Shellfish is one of the very few food allergies that can start in adulthood. It's extremely rare to have an adult come down with any food allergy other than shellfish. Mm-hmm. Now, children can have a shellfish allergy too, and it certainly can start in childhood and persist. But I just saw a patient yesterday who had grown up eating lobster in New England and ate it last week and developed an acute allergic reaction. So, and I've seen patients in their 60s come down with shellfish allergy. And that tends to persist, of course. That's not going to go away.
So once you have that, that will always be the same?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, let's talk. Okay, move off of food and talk a little bit more to what we're getting ready to experience, this airborne blossoming of, I guess, trees and grasses, everything budding in the spring, which is, we basically, I think, live in the middle of a forest. So when it all blooms in the spring, we get miserable. But tell us kind of what's happening there.
Yeah, well, a few years back, a national organization named Atlanta is the number one worst city for asthma and allergies, because one reason why is there are so many trees here. So tree pollination in Atlanta is going to begin in February and persist probably until April, when grass pollen really, really starts up. And that will persist really until June and even into July. So we do have a long allergy season in Atlanta. Tree and grass tend to be probably cause the most severe allergies, the most severe seasonal allergies that we see. So we recommend patients start treating their allergies before the onset of the peak pollination, which would be in a few weeks. So if you're someone who starts getting spring allergies, start treating yourself now, or see an allergist, get diagnosed, and figure out the best ways to treat your allergies or cure your allergies.
Why do you say start now? Does it take you a few weeks of taking that medicine to kind of get the histamine response down?
Yes, that's right. It's possible that you might prevent the excessive release of histamine by starting the antihistamines earlier, or even better, if you start allergy shots early, then you'll actually completely reverse your allergic profile and where you won't be reacting at all.
Okay. Now that we're on seasonal allergies, I know also in the fall there seems to be like a secondary season in Atlanta. Is there a different thing blooming then? Or it seems like all the budding's done, so I'm not sure why we're miserable then also, but we are.
Yeah, fall season, it tends not quite as bad in Atlanta as springtime pollen season, but in the fall you have weed pollen, ragweed probably being the chief culprit, which in Atlanta is going to start pollinating really, starts in late August, but continues into November and sometimes even to December. You got to have a couple consecutive freezes to really completely eliminate it. And there's some other weeds that can cause fall seasons too. And molds can cause symptoms really year round, because they can be both in the indoor and outdoor environment.
Right. Okay. What about, let's move off of the seasonal allergies and talk a little bit about medication allergies.
A lot of frequently we see the patients, they're on their chart will say penicillin allergy, and it's usually because they may have had a rash when they were very young when they took penicillin, but it's usually the reaction occurred many years ago, and usually it was not severe. Sometimes the patient doesn't even remember what it was. They say, well, my mother told me I had a reaction to it, so I've avoided it my whole life. That penicillin allergy we can easily test for with skin testing. Sometimes we'll frequently give a dose of penicillin in the office and observe the patient just to be extra sure. But we can remove that from the chart, and I Well, 99% of the people we typically test for, which is extremely helpful because that means that as outpatients, they can be treated with sometimes more effective
variety,
medications.
Yeah.
And especially if they become hospitalized, that's when it becomes even more important to not have it on the chart in case they have a severe infection, then use IV antibiotics.
So that be more like a sense, like distinguish between like a sensitivity, like when you say, well, something happened,
yeah.
But it's not like, let's talk a little bit about anaphylaxis since we're at this spot. So what's the difference between I took erythromycin and something happened I might be more sensitive to, I can't breathe, I need an EpiPen,
yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, and we see that a lot. We'll see a medication, frequently an antibiotic listed on a patient's chart as an allergy, and I'll say, well, what happened? And they might say, well, I had a headache, or it caused me to have a rash, or caused me to have diarrhea. Those can be adverse, unwanted effects sometimes of a medication, but that's not an anaphylactic reaction. Anaphylactic reaction is where you have at least two organ systems affected, or one organ system that's severely affected, such as in your lungs, that would be wheezing, shortness of breath, chest tightness.
Is that the most common? Respiratory?
No, the most common reaction probably on when I take a patient history is usually a skin. It's usually some type of rash. Many of the rashes are not dangerous.
And is it a systemic rash?
It doesn't.
Or does it pop up like more in your face or joints? Or
if it's a widespread rash, we take it more seriously.
Okay.
If it's just some splotchiness in certain small areas of your body, then it's usually not as serious of a sign. But that is one that is something allergists can help differentiate is between determine if someone's at risk for a life-threatening drug or allergic reaction in the future, or if it was an adverse reaction that we don't have to be quite as cautious about.
And are there most common medications that people are allergic to, or families of medications?
In adults, penicillin is probably the most likely one we see on the chart because most adults receive penicillin when they're very young. Nowadays, children just don't get prescribed penicillin often, so you frequently see amoxicillin on a child's chart, which most doctors probably know that amoxicillin often causes, most pediatricians will often know this, I take that back, will cause a rash. After a patient's taken it for 1 week, it's usually not severe. That's probably the most common antibiotic that causes a rash is amoxicillin. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that child is necessarily going to have a life-threatening allergic reaction in the future to it. Because
okay, now that we're on anaphylaxis, I know that there's EpiPens that people use. What's the most common treatment? Once you identify that they are truly possible for anaphylactic experience.
Yeah, well, if you think someone's at risk for having an anaphylactic reaction, you always want to prescribe epinephrine auto-injector. There's two brands available. There's the EpiPen, which has been around for years. There's a new brand that's called AuviQ, AUVI-Q, which I'm starting to prescribe more and more. It's a nice little convenient device that's about the size of a very small cell phone. And it has voice instructions, an audio instructions cue that tells the patient exactly how to use it.
Mm.
So it kind of makes it dummy proof,
mm-hmm.
and which is great for parents whose children may be outside their care, and they want to make sure their grandparents and teachers mm-hmm. know how to use it.
So for the ones maybe not as familiar, it kind of plays it down or step by step instructions.
Yes, it's a wonderful new device.
Very good. We're all being geared toward telling us in electronics and things like that. Well, let's talk about the last one, which is actually applicable in my family, and that's flying insects. So we're heading into the pollen and the bees. After the pollen come the flowers and the bees. So talk to us a little bit about...
Yeah, I think what we call flying insect allergy or fire ant allergy, the other type of insect allergy that we do see in Atlanta, I think it's one of the great underdiagnosed areas of allergy or... because not only is it relatively common, it's also life-threatening, and it's curable. So the way you would know you had a anaphylactic reaction or a systemic reaction to a flying insect is if you're an adult and you get hives after an insect sting or fire ant being an insect, then that is a sign that, that you're sensitized. You have IgE antibodies, which mediate the allergic reaction to that that insect, and you could have a more severe reaction in the future. Every year, a lot more people die in America from an allergic reaction to an insect sting than to a food allergy. Insect sting just doesn't get as much press, and it actually insect allergy is more risky in older people actually than it is in younger people, and frequently people will never not see a doctor, not tell their doctors about the reaction, and it's never addressed. But the great news about the insect allergy is that it can be cured with allergy shots, and someone can become desensitized to the insect very quickly in a matter of, truly in a matter of weeks, perhaps even days, to the point where they should not have a severe life-threatening reaction if they were stung again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that when I was a kid in my high school, a lady was cutting grass that was one of the teachers, and she ran over like a beehive, and she was by herself, and she got stung, didn't realize she was sensitive to it, and she passed away.
Yeah.
So I think when you say it's serious, I think people do need to take that seriously.
Yeah, and unfortunately that happens a lot. Many fatalities due to insect stings are actually the first time the patient patient experiences a reaction to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now that we know a little bit about the types of allergies and kind of what goes along with that, let's talk about some of the symptoms. So how do patients show up? Let's talk about mostly the one we're getting ready to have here in Atlanta. So patients show up, and how do they present to you? What do you see?
They'll list their complaints as usually itchiness of their eyes and nose, sneezing, nasal congestion. That's probably – congestion is the complaint that probably bothers people the – is a symptom that probably bothers people the most during allergy season or throughout the year if they're sensitized to dust mite and the other chronic allergens. Runny nose is another common symptom. Just – feeling a little bit not sick, like you have a cold. I don't mean your whole body aches and you can't get out of bed, but they don't feel 100% when they have their allergies, and it can affect their sleep. It can also affect their productivity at work. There's a lot of studies that show how many millions, if not billions, of dollars were lost due to work productivity. And for children, it affects their school as well. It affects their performance greatly.
Yeah, so I think when we get that bloom, we all start feeling miserable. We tend to try to self-medicate first, so we run and get the over-the-counter Visine eye drops and Claritin and things like that. But what's the break point that you're done with yourself and you're going to have to now see an allergist to get relief?
I mean, if your symptoms are mild and they're treated appropriately, or that they're treated to your satisfaction with over-the-counter antihistamines, and you don't mind paying for the antihistamines, then you don't necessarily need to be evaluated. The people who need to be evaluated by an allergist would be those who have kind of chronic allergen symptoms, and we see that a lot, especially in young adults, due to dust mite allergy. Mm-hmm. Dust mites live in the house. They're present year-round. Their symptoms tend to be a little worse usually in the winter when people are bottled up in their houses. And so the people with the chronic symptoms have a lower threshold to treat with allergy shots. The people with seasonal allergies frequently want to have allergy shots if they've tried their over-the-counter antihistamines, they're still having symptoms.
Now, for over-the-counter medications, do you have any recommendations of what's not worth it, what's a better product if you're at home just with mild symptoms?
Yeah. Well, the non-sedating antihistamines are usually the ones we recommend because they have less side effects. The non-sedating ones would be loratadine, which was the brand name Claritin, fexofenadine, which is a brand name Allegra, and cetirizine, which is a brand name Zyrtec. All those have a long half-life, so they kind of can give you 24-hour protection. Benadryl is the old standby, of course, is effective too. It's just shorter acting and has more side effects. But you know, if you're someone who kind of suffers for 3 months or 4 months during your season and you want to eliminate your need for medications and not have to go to the drugstore and grocery store to stock up, then, you know, you might want to explore the possibility of allergy shots, because it's a once a month injection that can make you immune to those allergens and allow you not to rely on them, not to rely on the medications.
So that's a good point to jump into. We've gone through the kinds, how you present, you make a decision. Now we're going to go to an allergist. We come into the office. I know that there's extensive history taking. There's skin testing. Let's kind of go through, if I was a patient of yours, what happens when I get there?
Well, the physician will take a history and determine what symptoms bother you the most and try to identify what triggers you could be having. It could be animals. Sometimes it is the pollen, and sometimes it's the dust mite. Then we kind of get an idea of the patient and what's worked for them in the past, and then we do the skin prick testing, which takes about 15 minutes total. It is painless, no blood or needles involved, and we can actually see the results, within 10 to 20 minutes, and tell the patient exactly what they're allergic to, educate them how to avoid those allergens, and talk to them about the option of allergy shots or immunotherapy. It's another word for allergy shots.
Okay, so let's go back to the skin testing, because I want to know exactly what's going to happen. So how many different things can you test me for on a visit?
Yeah. Our skin testing panel consists of about 70 allergens that all are found in the Atlanta area. We don't test for things that are found in other parts of the country that aren't found here. And we place those pricks on the arms, about 30 on one arm, 40 on the other arm, which, again, just takes a few minutes to place. And then the patient literally just waits for about 15 minutes for those skin pricks to react. They can read, use their iPad or iPhone while they're waiting. And then the size of the reactions will be read, and then the physician will discuss the results and talk about the best way to treat the allergens.
Okay, so then let's go. So let's just say you find a number of things that I'm in. You recommend that I do have the immunotherapy. So explain to us about how long of a process is that usually. I know it involves custom mixing for me. I may not get the same thing as the next person. Start from the beginning and tell us a little bit about allergy shots.
Okay.
What to expect and how they work.
All right. Well, allergy shots have been around for about 102 years and have been really was the first treatment for allergies when they were invented in England. And they're still the best treatment for allergies. It's the only treatment that actually alters the way the body responds to the allergens and which can essentially lead to a cure. And the patient will see symptom benefit in as fast as a month. I've had one patient tell me in 1 week after starting shots, he felt a lot better. But always within the first year, they should have a significant decrease in their symptoms. And in some cases, a complete 100% elimination of their symptoms.
So can you be cured of an allergy, or it depends on the type of allergy?
Yeah. Yes, you can be cured. I mean, not 100% of people who start shots will experience 100% reduction in symptoms, but they have done studies that show that the benefits of allergy shots persist long after they're discontinued. We discontinue shots after a patient has been on them for 3 to 5 years. Studies show that they really need to take them for that long to experience a lasting, perhaps permanent benefit. So we would stop the shots after someone has been on them 3 to 5 years and hope that the patient doesn't relapse. And can remain symptom free.
So do I come to your office for the shots?
Yeah, it's definitely recommended to get allergy shots in a physician's office. Our shots we give once a month for the vast majority of that 3 to 5 year duration. It's simply a monthly injection. When you first start allergy shots, it is a weekly injection. But in most cases, that only lasts for about 2 months, the weekly injections, and then the patient moves on to a once-a-month injection.
Okay. And the reason for doing it in the doctor's office is?
The reason for doing it is to, A, ensure the patient is getting is going to get the proper dose, mm-hmm. and it's mainly for safety mm-hmm. In case the patient experiences an allergic reaction to the shot. That's the risk of immunotherapy, is allergic reaction to the shot.
Okay. Now, I know you do a special kind of therapy. Not everybody does in an allergy office, called rush immunotherapy. Can you tell us how that's different and the benefits of rush compared to regular allergy shot?
Yeah, rush immunotherapy, it was...
What does rush stand for?
Rush, it just means fast or rapid.
Okay.
The kind of most common way allergy shots are given across America is a weekly injection that can last for months, 6 months at least. But many years ago, some allergists decided that if you were to give higher doses in a more of a rapid rapid way, when there's space closer together, like every hour instead of every week, you can actually desensitize the patient faster and basically jump about 4 months worth of shots in 1 day. So this method we use in our office, and it is far and away the most popular schedule for patients, because it decreases their trips to the doctor's office by 75% in the first 6 months, and basically overall saves them time. Instead of having to come for a weekly 30-minute injection for 4 months, they come for a 1 5-hour day, in which during the time they can spend reading, studying, working on their laptop. They just get a shot every hour.
And then how do you monitor? I think that'd be close monitoring then, if you're loading them up that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the patients, they have their own room, and they're observed. You know, we're always checking on them to ask them how they're doing, how they're feeling. Of course, if patients mention that they're feeling like they could be having an allergic reaction, then we always evaluate them and treat them appropriately. If we have to give them epinephrine, we give them epinephrine, which in every case we've ever done that, within minutes the patient feels back to normal. We've never had a patient actually stop allergy shots due to allergic reaction to the injections. They always keep going and continue.
Mm-hmm. And then would it just be that 1 day, or they'd have to come back and do another cycle?
Yeah, most patients who do rush do 1 5-hour day, and then the next week they come back for a 3-hour day. And then after that, they have 6 weekly injections, and then they're at their monthly maintenance dose. Some patients may just want to do 1 day of rush, but even that will save them from several months of injections.
So for all of you crunched for time, rather than go through the monthly, weekly, you can just compress the time. That's the big advantage of that.
Yes, exactly.
You just have to be monitored in the office, getting loaded up.
Exactly right.
Making sure what your thing is. Okay, well, we've talked a little bit about what happens when I come in the office, skin testing to see what you're allergic to. We've talked about patient education. We've talked about the immunotherapy. Any other treatments that patients should be aware of that they may be candidates for?
Yeah, prescription nasal sprays are the best medications for nasal symptoms, especially nasal congestion. That's probably my most commonly prescribed medication would be a nasal spray. There's two classes, nasal steroid and then the nasal antihistamine is the other category. So I frequently prescribe one or both of those. Someone experiencing a lot of eye itching, redness, and watering, I will frequently prescribe or recommend that they take an antihistamine eye drop. But those are the big classes of medications that I usually recommend.
Okay. Now, we're getting ready to come into the season. We know we'll all live through it. But in general, is the incidence of allergy going up around us? Is it staying the same? Is it getting worse? I heard you say Atlanta was one of the top worst allergy cities, but nationally, what's kind of happening?
Yeah, I don't know that there's any data on the prevalence of, say, allergic rhinitis in 2013 compared to 20 years ago, allergic rhinitis being the allergic inflammation of the nose, which is the most common allergy symptom when people say they have, quote, allergies. It is. I think people are becoming more aware of their symptoms and the fact that there is treatment available for them. Food allergies, we have a little more hard data on and how mm-hmm. it's increasing. But
mm-hmm. And then any final tips to patients? We've talked a little about over-the-counter medicine, going to see your doctor, start early, like start now before it's actually here is probably one of the most beneficial things I think I've heard you say. But any other final tips?
Yes. I would recommend patients see a physician who has been formally trained in allergy with a 2 to 3 year fellowship, which is just a postgraduate education beyond the minimum 3 year residency that doctors have to complete. So in fellowship training, physicians have really done nothing but allergy for 2 or 3 years, focused on it, learned the best ways to test and treat, and it just should make the patient have a better overall experience than if they just go to any healthcare provider that's out in the community that might be advertising their allergy services. It's just like anything. If you go to a specialist, you're usually going to get more individualized and customized care.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything coming up on the horizon that people that want to research more should know about or look into that's kind of the hot topic in allergy or immunology?
One of the most interesting new developments in allergy is the idea of perhaps being able to desensitize people to food allergies, mainly children. So there's research being done at Duke University and some other places where they're taking children who may be allergic to peanut or milk and giving them the peanut and milk orally over time, which can actually protect them, kind of desensitize them to the food allergy. I think that's could be one of the most helpful developments. It's not being done in private practice. We don't have enough data to know how much, how safe the exact protocols and how to do it. But it could prevent, fatalities from pediatric food allergy if it becomes safe and approved. And
okay, very good. Well, that wraps up our show today. We've talked a lot about allergies. We've given you some tips. I think the two most important things I heard are start early, start now before this bloom is here, and don't be miserable. Get in to see an allergist that can help you out of the gate probably faster and with more expertise. So I appreciate that. So for all of our listeners wanting to come and see you, how would we find you?
ReadingAllergyCenter.com. You can find us on the internet, 404-355-0078. Is our phone number. We can see patients generally always within a week. And
do you have early or late hours? Because I know you have a lot of patients coming in for shots. So yeah, making it convenient is important.
Yeah, we open at 8 o'clock a couple days, and we stay open till 5 o'clock most days of the week.
Okay, sounds great. Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. And all you listeners out there, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. And please visit our sponsor's website, www.healthgate.com. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.